Mark Sobel. I'm the U.S. Chair of OMFIF. Today, OMFIF and I have the great pleasure of hosting Heath Tarbert, Chairman and Chief Executive of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, perhaps the most powerful regulator most of the public hasn't heard about. Heath also serves on the U.S. Financial Stability Oversight Council. He's the Vice Chair of IOSCO. And prior to CFTC, Heath was acting Undersecretary and an Assistant Secretary at Treasury for International Affairs, where he oversaw Treasury's participation in the Financial Stability Board. He chaired the US-EU Financial Regulatory Forum, and he led the efforts on CFIUS modernization. So Heath and I will kick off with the fireside chat, followed by two brief lead discussants, Stephen Pickford and Dick Berner. So Heath, it's a delight to have you back, and welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your tenure at CFTC has overlapped with one of the most challenging periods ever for a financial regulator, especially given COVID and the off-the-charts financial market pressures in March and April. So how did this impact the CFTC? What actions did you take? How did it go? Any thoughts and lessons for us?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, there's that old adage, you know, may you live in interesting times, but this wasn't quite what I expected when I took the helm of the CFTC. The good news is I think overall we have a very good story to tell. And when I think about it, Mark, I guess there were multiple dimensions to dealing with, you know, what I think everyone would agree was the biggest crisis facing health crisis and economic crisis probably since the Great Depression and the pandemic in 1918. And it wasn't a financial crisis, but it could have been. It could have been, and luckily it didn't result in a financial crisis. And so when I think about what we had to do, first of all, there's the internal, just simply the agency itself. We have 700 full-time employees in four different offices, as well as 300 contractors. So that's about 1,000 people that work at today's CFTC. And the question was, what do we do? The good news is that for the most part, we had signed telework agreements in the months preceding this the crisis, because people have an option, at least certain people, to work a day from home each week, telework. And so we had telework agreements in place, but we had never tested a telework of that magnitude. So right before, when it looked like COVID was spreading, we did a telework test on a Friday afternoon. And by Monday over the weekend, it was clear that no one was going back to work. So luckily that test worked. And since March, the agency has been 100% remote, including myself. But we've been able to get an extraordinary amount of stuff done, but just the safety and health of our employees was number one. But secondly, during the midst of all of this, we had our mission, obviously. And so the thing that we really needed to focus on was making sure that our markets remained orderly and liquid with this unprecedented volatility, as you mentioned. So what we had to do is put our strategic plan aside, which was sort of a carefully laid out plan of all sorts of things we were doing, and one of the most ambitious plans that the CFTC has had in probably a decade, but we needed to pivot immediately to dealing with the crisis. So we issued more than a dozen no action and other types of relief just to make sure that the markets could continue to function while people were socially distancing. And so a number of things were put in there to that end. We also talked with some of our fellow regulators in the United States to address things like liquidity needs, the LCR, to make sure that market makers and other people had the lines of liquidity that they needed to continue the markets remaining. I think the third point is that we witnessed a live stress test. If anyone was wondering, well, how is this whole new Dodd-Frank regime going to hold up, particularly centralized clearing? Well, I think we have our answer, and the answer is a good one. Overall, I think our system was served as a shock absorber for systemic risk as opposed to an amplifier. And I think back when you guys were working, Stephen, you, Mark, on sort of the post-crisis reforms, when we had the bilateral OTC market where there wasn't necessarily initial and variation margin exchange in a systematic way and fewer things were going through clearinghouses, there was a real concern about counterparty credit risk. Well, that didn't happen here. By and large, our system infrastructure stayed up. It was incredibly resilient, and we collected on average in the clearinghouse, or in terms of magnitude, something like $56 billion of margin during that initial period. So overall, I think we're still looking back and we're taking a diagnostic test to figure out, are there tweaks we need to make? But overall, I think it was a very important test of our system, a real live stress test. And then finally, I would say, And this is somewhat paradoxical. On the international front, I think we're more connected than we've ever been with our fellow regulators. And that would seem odd because I was literally in Madrid at an IOSCO meeting in February when COVID sort of took shape in Europe. And we all took tests to get in and our temperature was checked. And then it was a couple of weeks later where it clearly came to the United States and it was very clear it was a worldwide pandemic. And therefore, the intuition was, as well, forget these international meetings. We're not going to be doing them for a while. But what we did was, is we ended up substituting those with what we're doing here today. And as a result, we actually held far more of them. So I am talking more regularly with my international counterparts now than I ever have before. And I would say I'm probably talking to my international counterparts more than even at Treasury when my full-time job was to talk to my international counterparts. So that was a surprise, but we really needed to coordinate not just here in the United States, but also internationally. And so we're doing that as well.
Well, great. That's a great lead in. You've been at CFTC for a year. In addition to what you've discussed about your actions to address COVID, what do you view as some of your key accomplishments? We see a lot of wrangling in Washington, D.C. How's the CFTC doing?
Well, first of all, I think we've tried to make the CFTC. I've got great colleagues on the commission, and all of us have our specific viewpoints. And, we don't always see eye to eye. But I think one of the things I've tried to do with the CFTC, with the help of my fellow commissioners, is to sort of have everyone view us as, look, they don't always agree on policy issues, but at the end of the day, there are adults in the room that we can have civil discourse, we can work together, and we can keep issues to the substance. Now, that said, I think if you look at our voting record, particularly on even very important rule sets, 80 to 90% of them are bipartisan. So we really have been able to reach agreement on many things. If I would say, well, what did I try to do when I first arrived at the CFTC? Well, the CFTC has undergone dramatic changes since the Dodd-Frank Act. Literally, the agency's territory, jurisdiction has expanded, somewhere between 2 and 5-fold, maybe even more than that, with over-the-counter swaps. And so the agency was busy toiling away for the first 5 years after that, and then I think fell into a period where people needed direction, quite frankly. And when I came into the agency, I tried to meet in groups of maybe 30 to 40 with all the employees in various divisions and get a sense of what was going on in the agency. And it was very clear to me that there needed to be a renewed sense of purpose and mission, and then a direction, not just sort of looking backwards, but also looking forward. So we enhanced our mission statement, a vision statement for the first time in 45 years, core values, and then with that, a strategic plan. And so now every single person in the agency knows all of these things, and we voted on them, actually. The mission statement, the vision, and the core values, we actually had the agency personnel submit ideas to us. We fashioned a bunch of different formulations, and everyone voted. So now I think there's an invigorated sense of purpose that was even elevated by the crisis as well. So we did that. And just to tell you in terms of numbers, we have had 16 open meetings since I joined, and that's more than the prior 6 years combined prior to my coming. So the agency's working harder than ever. I think we've got 20 proposals out, 24 final rules, and the rest of this year will be on finalizing the things that we propose. So an amazing amount of output, and we can talk about the various specifics, but just the big picture is that this is an agency that is working harder than ever.
Well, thank you for that. You must have a large share of the adults in Washington, if all your commissioners are. So in preparing for today, I read up again on one of my blasts from the past, which is cross-border swap regulation, deference, equivalence, chats with the Europeans. I read some of the proceedings of the final rule, so I had a comment and a question. Mm-hmm. My comment was, your opening remarks seemed pretty critical of the 2013 cross-border guidance, citing foreign complaints about fragmentation and whatnot. And I was thinking back to the time, I had a hand in the Pittsburgh Summit communique where we agreed on exchange trading for standardized OTC derivatives and clearing them through CCPs by the end of 2012 at the latest. And my sense in those intervening years was that the Europeans really weren't moving forward. The CFTC was plunging into new terrain, and there were plenty of consultations with the Europeans As you know, there was a path forward in 2013 on deference. There was a 2016 common approach. You just signed a penned a op-ed with Mr. Dombrovskis. So deference kind of has been a work in progress over all these years. But it strikes me that the Pittsburgh Summit commitment wouldn't have been met in a somewhat timely manner had it not been for the CFTC's push in those days. That's my comment. My question is, there were dissenting views to the July 2020 CFTC rule from some of your members, from Better Markets and others, and they argued that the final rule would let U.S. persons book swaps with non-U.S. persons and offshore financial centers, steer clear of CFTC regulation even when the activities took place in the U.S. or the parent was responsible for the risks. I hope I got that right. But what is your answer to that critique?
Yeah, well, first, let me start with your comment, which is back in 2012, you know, there was a CFTC was first out the door. And I think that's fine. And one of the things I was very specific not to do is to sort of ask the question whether at the time it was the right decision. But what we're really focused on is now, 8 years later, is that the right approach? And my answer is a clear no. I think we definitely went very far back in 2012. And as you say, it may have been necessary to get everyone else to the table and to adopt those accords, the Pittsburgh summit, you know, agreements. But now we're there, right? So now we're there. So then you have to ask the question, now that everyone has adopted similar regimes, do we still take that, what as some have been called the intergalactic commerce clause approach? And I think the answer there is no. And I applied, borrowed from Immanuel Kant, his, you know, categorical imperative, which essentially asked the question, if everyone applied the same kind of extraterritorial regime, where would we be? Would it make sense? And I think the answer has to be no there because we'd have overlapping duplicative. It would be a mess. So what I would say is 2012, 2013 may not have been the time for deference. I think now it clearly is. So then the question becomes, well, how far do we go? What does the statute say? Well, the statute, I think, makes very clear that you want to focus on things that will have an impact on the United States and our markets, essentially. And so the Congress made very clear that the swaps regime was not to apply extraterritorially unless it would have this significant effect here in the United States. So then we asked ourselves the question, well, what is the significant effect? The 2012 and 2013 rules had us applying very bizarre situations where you could have a UK and a French counterparty over in Europe trading a swap with subsidiaries of let's say, a U.S. bank involved, but again, headquartered in the U.K., and yet you would be applying U.S. transaction rules to that if there was anyone, you know, in the United States that played any role whatsoever, arranged, negotiated, even though the swap was between two non-U.S. counterparties and booked overseas, right? And so clearly that cannot be the answer. So we pared that back. And we looked at a couple of things. So the first thing is we thought about risk coming back to the United States. And so where there is a bank holding company and the Federal Reserve is supervising on a consolidated basis, I think our view there was that the CFTC doesn't necessarily need to apply our swap and registration requirements in those instances, because ultimately if it rolls up to the Federal Reserve to a consolidated bank holding company that the Fed is supervising, then we have a U.S. regulator looking out for those prudential supervisory considerations already. However, if there is a direct guarantee from a U.S. company overseas, then we do in fact count that. And then finally, we looked at and we said, what's the thing that we have to be most worried about? Where basically there is material risk that could be generated overseas and eventually find itself back to the United States where there's no one else watching. And so this is what I'd call the backdoor Enron scenario, where you could have a subsidiary of a U.S. company that's not subject to consolidated prudential supervision by the Fed or another U.S. regulator, but nonetheless creates a swap dealer in an offshore financial center. And so there we came up with the significant risk subsidiary, which is meant to target that. So AIG, assuming it wasn't a thrift holding company at the time, or an Enron, couldn't bring its swaps portfolio overseas, build up an immense amount of risk, and then have it come back to the U.S. So I do think it is a thoughtful, calibrated approach. And I think, again, our foreign counterparts overseas, some of whom may be represented on this call, would agree that it was a step in the right direction.
You wrote an interesting Harvard Business School article that about rules versus principle-based regulation. I enjoyed it greatly. I thought it was a sophisticated, pragmatic effort to strike the balance, but also to shift the balance a bit more towards principles-based regulation. Coming back to my experiences with the global financial crisis, we had this debate about principles versus rules-based regulation before the crisis and light touch regulation. I know you see the two as different. But there were concerns that rules-based regulation could be too legalistic and check-the-box mentality and diminish due diligence. But then we had this little crisis in 2008 and 2009. And what we noted at the Washington Summit was that market participants failed to appreciate the risks inherent in their activities. They didn't exercise proper due diligence. We agreed and that there had been weak underwriting standards, unsound risk management practices, complexity, opacity, excess leverage. I've been reading in the papers in the last week about spoofing problems in futures markets, which I'm sure you're familiar with. So I'm a bit skeptical about self-regulation. I understand there's no perfect way to provide oversight, but I'm still a bit chastened by the global financial crisis. And I wonder if a shift towards more principle-based regulation is a move in the right direction.
Yeah, so great set of issues. And I've tried to sort of lay out, first of all, I think it's important that we realize that it is a false dichotomy, that it must either all be principles or also all be based on rules. And one of the things that I think we want to avoid is this sort of bipolar situation with financial regulation where we're swinging to the left or to the right or from principles to rules. And so my view is that actually you can have some objective content to deciding whether something should be more principles-based or more rules-based, but ultimately recognizing that to some extent it's a blend of the two. And so there are certain things that lend themselves more rules-based and then other things that make sense for more principles-based. And of course, the critique is on both sides. First of all, principles-based, as you mentioned, my view is that that's not the same thing as light touch. Light touch, I don't really view as regulation at all, but more monitoring. Whereas principles-based is putting the obligations at a high enough level that there's flexibility for market participants, but there's also flexibility for the regulators, right? And if you think about our capital and stress testing regime, that's principles-based, right? Stress testing as well as CCAR. A lot more principles-based than, let's say, the specific Basel rules. So the Fed sort of blends the two. And again, I think market participants like it when it favors them. They don't like it when it doesn't favor them. But ultimately, that's the way it cuts. Rules-based, on the other hand, has also been criticized because I think many people across the pond, some of whom are with us today, point to, let's say, the SEC regime and say, that was really rules-based. And people followed it to the T. And it led to a great demise in the United States during the financial crisis. So I think there's also a sense that rules-based didn't work as well. So what I try to do in that article is say, let's not sort of view this as an ideological debate, but rather, are there certain subject areas that lend themselves more to principles and other subject areas that lend themselves to rules? And while I think principles-based is rare, and so the CFTC is one of the few regulators that does it, and so hence there is this sort of emphasis of principles-based, I've also taken at the CFTC very recently things that were principles-based and then made them rules-based. And the big example is swap data reporting. We actually took a principles-based approach to swap data reporting where we basically said, look, these are all kinds of important things you should think about reporting, so please report them. And what we got was totally a bunch of stuff. Some people filling out 200 fields, some people filling out 160 fields. The information wasn't lined up, so it was totally useless as a data source. So in my article, I say when it comes to certain areas like that, reporting, we actually want a rules-based system so we can have uniformity and comparability and we can use the data. So we actually moved in that instance to a rules-based approach, where in other things, like for example, where you have great technological growth, things like high-frequency trading, electronic trading, etc., there, my concern is if you use a rules-based approach, it could come outdated in 2 years. And you know how, as hard as the CFTC is working, sometimes it takes a decade to get an important rule through. So if you have a principles-based approach, it provides more flexibility, sure, to the market participants, but also to the regulators. But the aim of the article is to sort of say, is there an objective way that we can start thinking?
It's a very important issue. So COVID caused lots of financial market ructions. The banks have held up well because of Basel III, I think. But the ructions shook the foundations of the Treasury and repo markets. They required extraordinary Fed action and even took the U.S. Into realms such as corporate muni bonds and Main Street lending, which was well beyond the 2009 playbook. So analysts long worried that regulating banks would cause activity to gravitate towards non-banks, areas outside the Fed's realm, but more in the FSOX, of which you're a member. Regulating non-banks is different than banks, and hence the primary focus is on activities rather than entities, which makes sense. But I don't understand concretely how activities regulation works, how you measure it, and whether that should come at the exclusion of an entities-based approach. And I was wondering on if you could elaborate on how these kinds of considerations impact the CFTC.
Yeah, no, so great question. And I think, you know, my view has always been we need activities-based alongside entities-based designations, because I do think there are certain institutions that could benefit from a entities-based designation that we clearly know about, and I'd say they're in twofold. First, the big G-SIBs effectively, and those are effectively designated by statute by the Dodd-Frank Act, because they're large systemically important bank holding companies, and they're sort of statutory SIFIs, if you will. And then there's another class of non-bank financial companies that may or may not fall within that category. And then, of course, you've got the CCPs, the clearinghouses, and the payment systems, which in some cases, the Dodd-Frank Act and the G20 reforms actually created systemic risk. They created systemically important entities for a good reason, to centralize risk, to be able to see it, and all the reasons that I've talked about before. But nonetheless, they, in my view, require a designation as well. But then we've got all these other activities out there. Or my main concern is that if we just had an entities-based approach for certain kinds of fund platforms or certain kinds of products, we would be playing the whack-a-mole game, where we would try to be designating, you know, a hedge fund, and then the risk would just simply migrate to another entity. Because unlike the big systemically important G-SIBs, which have a charter and which have been around for a number of years, these other things can move very rapidly and quickly. So I think a focus on activities makes sense. Now, then the question becomes, well, how do you do that? And that is really what we're grappling with now. Probably the best example of an activities-based approach that I can think of that actually came out of the financial crisis, what we've done with OTC margin. So there, of course, we haven't said, well, if you're AIG and you've got a big book of business, you know, we need to focus on you. But rather, we have said, if you're of a certain magnitude in terms of swap dealing or swap trading, if you will, a certain amount, you must have initial and variation margin exchanged, and you must sign onto the protocol. And as a result, the entire financial system now, or 96% of it, I think, is at present, has initial and variation margin exchanged on the bilateral swap side. So I would view that as an example of an activities-based approach, where if we had that in place in 2007, I really wonder whether we would have a crisis with AIG and some of these other firms when it came to the OTC swaps market, and particularly like CDS, for example. So that would be the concept. And now we're thinking about how do we apply that. And the biggest area that we've just started on is the GSEs and the mortgage products. Because there, I think you could have a strong argument that both Fannie and Freddie are systemically important and could be designated at some point. But that said, there are a lot of other players in the mortgage market. So focusing FSOC on that is, I think, in the next sort of order of business, what they're focused on. And that's not an area that I have a tremendous amount of depth on, but I know enough to know that it's pretty systemic.
Thanks. I think fleshing out the activities-based approach is something that merits much attention and further work in the United States of America. Let's hope it gets done. So the CFTC recently put out a report called Managing Climate Risks in the U.S. Financial System. Now, I recognize this was an advisory committee report and another commissioner was in charge, but I think between the Task Force on Climate Disclosure and the Network for Greening the Financial System, there's a substantial increase in awareness about the risks of climate change for the financial system. How has this impacted the CFTC's work, and should the CFTC be doing more on environmental sustainability issues, especially because Europe's going to move forward and could end up setting the agenda here?
Yeah, so first of all, as you mentioned, this is a report of a subcommittee on climate that then will go to our Market Risk Advisory Committee, and then ultimately they will decide what to recommend to the CFTC. But these subcommittee structures, I think, are very important. The SEC has them, but I think other regulators don't have them to the extent that we do. I'm looking at Dick Berner. He sits on one that is very important that's going to deal with incentives within CCPs. So if there's an issue that I think is controversial that warrants stakeholders and various viewpoints, we normally have a subcommittee look at it and make recommendations to the relevant advisory committee and so on and so forth. So I think in that sense, it's a helpful process. When I think about sort of the issues involving climate risk, many of the things that were in the subcommittee's report, of course, are not directed to the CFTC. They're directed to Congress, larger issues. But when I think about what should the CFTC's role be in all this going forward, the derivatives markets are the place where people go to hedge risk. So if there are risk involving climate change or perceived risk involving climate change, at the end of the day, it's ultimately what people in the marketplace perceive to be their risk and their exposure. My view is that the CFTC's role should be in helping foster innovation in derivatives instruments that are meant to address these issues. So, for example, I think just a couple of weeks ago, the CME issued water futures, which are a way with dealing with a particular type of perceived climate risk. And so I think that would be the CFTC's biggest role in this. We don't have supervisory authority over the oil and gas activities of some of our traders, right? We are focused entirely on the derivatives market. So where I think we really play a role in this larger debate is in fostering the ability of the derivatives markets to tackle these risks, just like the derivatives markets tackled the risk after the Bretton Woods collapse of interest rate risk, FX risk, et cetera. So that's where I see our role playing is continuing to have this dialogue and seeing if innovative products can be developed.
Well, let's turn to our discussants to put forward some questions. So Dick Berner, Morgan Stanley's longtime global chief economist, the first American head of the Office of Financial Research, which was created by Dodd-Frank, now a professor at New York Stern College of Business and a member of the CFTC Market Advisory Risk Committee. So Dick, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I wanted to ask specifically about the swap data reporting progress, since you've made a lot of progress in that area. And how's that coming along? And how's that coming along in particular in collaboration with your counterparts overseas with whom I know you're collaborating? And then second, one question related to overseas collaboration also, or rather domestic collaboration. In its FSAP, the recent FSAP, the IMF recommended a greater collaboration among the CFTC, the SEC, and the Fed, particularly for oversight of financial market utilities. And you, all three of you, share joint responsibility for that. How's that going to work in your view? And where do you see opportunities for greater collaboration?
Yeah, then let me start with your last question first, if I may. On that, I would say the CCPs are large, and everyone agrees they're systemically important in the United States. And I would say they may not be systemic overseas, but they certainly are important overseas, and everyone needs to kind of have some insight into them. The Fed and the SEC and us, so we don't work directly with the SEC because of their clearinghouses, but they do work with the Fed, and we also work with the Fed on those CCPs that we oversee. And what we've tried to do is to create an environment between the three regulators where we can share information and also conduct various tests, including liquidity stress tests. So we are working on that now. Now, we had planned on doing a joint liquidity stress test of both the CFTC and SEC regulated infrastructures early this year, but then we had the real life stress test. So that has made that OBE, so to speak, overcome by events as opposed to order of the British Empire. But we're still planning on a work program going forward. We're also working, though, with our international counterparts on CCPs. So I have literally just signed the crisis management agreements, which will allow sort of the colleges for each of the CCPs to work together to share information, particularly as we start to think about implementing as soon as the FSB's resolution and recovery plan guidance is available. We really want to get into the CCPs and really start assessing their resources for both resilience and recovery planning, but also potentially for resolution planning as well. So it is very important that we stay coordinated. First question you asked, swap data rules. We were very pleased to complete them at the end of last month. But as part of that process, what we did was, and I mentioned it earlier when I was talking with Mark, is that we had a sort of a principles-based approach where it wasn't particularly as specific and granular as they think we needed to be. Plus, the things we asked for didn't necessarily jive up with what the IOSCO recommended schedule was, nor with ESMA and what they were doing. So throughout that process, we actually started with the IOSCO schedule and looking at those data fields and thinking about where did it cross-reference and where could we sort of create uniformity. And we also sent our proposal over to ESMA for their team to look at it and to have a series of dialogues over a couple of months before we actually produced it. And we did the same thing with the SEC. So the hope is that now there are some CFTCs, data-specific fields, because internally, institutionally, there are some things that we just felt we really need as an agency. But by and large, I think we came to a consensus on many points of view, so we no longer have inconsistencies in data. And so the same data that goes to a European clearinghouse that goes to our clearinghouse at some point will be interoperable and be able to be, you know, sort of put together and used. On that note, I should tell you that we also created within IOSCO something called the FSEG, the Financial Stability Engagement Group. And it was a sense that over the years, as the FSB started getting more and more into the non-bank space, as Mark mentioned, that's definitely where lots of activity that we're seeing nowadays has flowed to. We wanted to make sure that IOSCO was playing a more proactive role. So we put together this FSEG, and within that, there is a data group that actually, for the first time ever, is collecting margin data on CCPs, putting them all together with a dozen or so more jurisdictions. So we've never actually had worldwide, effectively, margin data, initial and variation margin data on CCPs, and for the first time, we're able to do that. And as we implement our data rules, we'll be able to get that kind of data on all sorts of things as well.
That's terrific. Okay, one more area to throw you a bouquet, and that is on Lab CFTC. The work started by your predecessor, Chris Giancarlo, and that you've continued on Lab CFTC is terrific. It really helps us advance the use of technology appropriately for improving the regulatory and oversight process. And I don't know if you want to give a thumbnail sketch of that, but one area in particular that we might talk about is how we can use new technologies to improve that regulation and oversight and make it more effective and efficient and create less cost for both you and for the industry.
No, absolutely. So Lab CFTC, I think, has sort of a dual role. Its first role is to be a connection between the CFTC and innovators in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, particularly in areas like crypto and things that are now becoming part of 21st century commodities that we now find ourselves having jurisdiction over. So we literally have experts in corn and cattle. And now for the first time, we hired just a week or two ago, a Ivy League PhD economist with expertise in crypto, because now it's within our jurisdiction. But the second part of Lab CFTC's agenda is thinking about how the agency itself can use technology. So reg tech and things like that. We have a prize out, a prize competition for a reg tech sort of prize for us to be able to use technology. And I can tell you that in-house, we've actually developed technology to spot spoofing. And we've used that. And we actually had a case where, you know, it was essentially a cold fax case or whatever you want to call it. And we weren't able, just based on the data, until we got our algorithm in there to be able to uncover the fact pattern and marshal the evidence that we needed. We're also thinking about, as you guys develop your technology on the outside, how we can interface so regulatory reporting and things like that are easier. Another big project that I think won't be this year, but in future years, is I would like to take all of our no action letters, for example, and digitize those so companies can sort of be able to search them and run algorithms to hasten better compliance.
And I'd like to call on Stephen Pickford, who had a long distinguished career at the British Treasury, serving as the head of the International Division, the G7, G20 deputy, including during the financial crisis, where he held the pen on the London Summit communique. He's a longtime colleague, and he now chairs two ICE Benchmark Administration Oversight Committees for the ICE swap rate and for gold and silver prices. If Stephen is not here, he was going to ask, as a result of Brexit, a new border is being erected in Europe between the UK and EU. The final arrangements are yet to be determined, but UK-based institutions which dominate derivatives trading and clearing in Europe, are pressing to be granted equivalent rights by the EU. Assuming this comes to pass, what do you see as the implications for the US-UK regulatory arrangements?
I would say the first point there is one that the US has taken, and I took this position when I was at Treasury, and I know you either did or would have if you were running the Office of Financial Stability at Treasury, or the International Financial Stability Office, which is, if we had a situation where there really was a cliff edge and equivalence was withdrawn overnight, I think it would be a lose-lose for both Europe and the UK. So I was pleased to see at least the extension of equivalence for a certain period. Obviously, it's meant to be temporary, but that's a lot better than I think every year going through this scenario where we're worried about 90 days before having this sort of crash and burn approach. My ultimate hope is that the EU and the UK would work out something that would have mutual recognition and equivalence, similar to what they have today, but ultimately it's a political question. So the US won't involve itself in that other than to say that, you know, ultimately we hope to continue to have a strong transatlantic, you know, financial system. And so we've reached an accord with the EU. We're also doing everything we can to make sure our relations with the UK remain solid and strong. And I think they do. I mean, the UK, I've said before, we have not only a special relationship at a geostrategic level, but we also have over the years a special regulatory relationship that I know Mark and others have been, and Stephen have been part of for a long time. And that, I think, you know, has enabled us to work quite well together because there's a deep level of trust. And the institutions involved are not new. ESMA is a pretty new player to this game. It literally just got its authority to regulate third country CCPs, for example, within the last year or so. Whereas the Bank of England has been regulating CCPs since they existed. And the CFTC has been doing it for 45 years and the Fed for a long time as well. So we have a longstanding relationship. And I think that's only going to be strengthened. And I hope in the near future to be able to announce something that us and the Bank of England are working on in that regard.
Something to look forward to. And I know that when I used to go to Brussels, I'd take the Channel train over to London immediately afterwards. His second question was, the CFTC has led the way in easing the transition from LIBOR-based derivatives to ones based on SOFR. In the UK, the administrator is working on developing benchmark rates based on SONIA as markets move away from LIBOR-based products. How quickly do you see the transition to SOFR happening in the US? And what more might need to be done to accelerate the transition?
Yeah, so I would say the harder transition, of course, is in the cash markets, is in the loan markets. As we've spoken together, there are probably still loans that have been written in the United States and probably elsewhere based on LIBOR. Hopefully not too many, but that I think is the tougher issue. For us in the derivatives markets, I think we're in good shape. First of all, on the future side and exchange traded side, we are ready in just literally a week and a half to move from the Fed funds rate, which was formerly sort of a LIBOR based model, to SOFR. So that's actually going to happen and in London as well, but certainly here in the United States, our clearinghouses are sort of moving to that calculation methodology, and we have SOFR futures trading. The volume is relatively low. It's getting larger. But right now, of course, we don't have hedgers there. We just have speculators. But once the cash market moves to sort of SOFR, then you're going to see that go up as well. On the OTC side, the ISDA protocols are done. The Department of Justice gave its approval and its blessing that it didn't create any competition law issues. So my hope is that will be adopted, that protocol, over the next year. And if that's the case, I think, you know, we are well placed in the derivatives markets to make the switch when it comes about. I will say, you know, I know SOFR in the United States is sort of the current alternative rate that we have, and SONIA in the UK. But I think from the CFTC vantage point, my main concern is just making sure we transition off LIBOR to some kind of alternative rate. SOFR is what we've got now, but that doesn't mean that down the road there can't be other alternative rates. And I think, you know, we remain neutral on that point. But the main concern is the systemic risk that could arise if we just moved off LIBOR cold turkey, or LIBOR went away and we were left with a situation where we had nothing and we literally had $600 trillion of assets or instruments that couldn't be priced.
Well, I have to thank you for offering such lucid answers to all of our questions and for the tremendous efforts you're making at the CFTC. I commend you, wish you the best. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.